Okay, so I feel like a bit of an imposter speaking in this session because looking at the room, I struggle to find a single person who knows less about stellar rotation than I do. I don't believe that. I'm not going to try to pretend to explain anything about stellar rotation. Oh, thank you.
Really? I need this?
Yes.
I think I'm pretty loud.
No, even it's recorded.
All right. Well, good thing then the people who are listening to the recording didn't hear the introduction and didn't run off immediately by realizing that they're listening to somebody who has no idea what they're talking about. But so what I'm going to try to do is I'm going to try to just motivate, you know, why I'm standing up here and how I got interested in the rotation issue. And then I'm going to tag team with Pablo. So if you have any really difficult questions, hold on until Pablo speaks. I'm sure he can answer them better than I can. But by way of motivation, so I've been working on, for those who don't know me, I'm at the University of Birmingham in the UK, and I've been working for the last 15 years or so on things related to compact binaries and gravitational wave sources. And in particular, for the last several years, I've been thinking about, you know, how do we actually form massive compact object binaries? And there's one fundamental problem, I would say, in terms of forming massive binaries. And this problem is, you might describe it as either a timescale problem or a spatial separation problem. But the way to think about this is the following. If you ask, what is the timescale for a binary, once you already have two compact objects, you go from a given frequency, orbital frequency, to merger, this scales as frequency to the minus 8/3 power times this finite mass combination called the Chirp mass to the minus 5/3 power. And if you want to recast this in terms of just masses and separation, it looks like a separation to the 4th power times masses cubed, just Kepler's law. So the separation to the 4th power is a problem. It basically says that the gravitational wave timescale, maybe instead of calling this DCO, I should call this GW for gravitational waves. So the gravitational wave timescale is a pretty strong power of the separation, right? Gravitational waves aren't very efficient in removing orbital energy. If the binary is wide, they only become very efficient if the binary is close together. And what that means is, if you actually put in all the right prefactors, is that if you want your binary to merge within the age of the universe, after you have formed your two compact objects, your separation has to be few to few tens of solar radii, depending on the masses. So a few tens, 40 solar radii, let's say a fifth of an astronomical unit. If you're talking about a 30 plus 30 solar mass binary black hole, few if you're talking about much lighter systems. So what's the problem? Well, the problem is we all know that massive stars at some point in their evolution get to be a lot bigger than a few tens of solar radii. So the fundamental problem is, how do you take stars that are this big and put them in a binary that's this small without just having them merge at some point much earlier during their evolution, which may be fun and great and so on, but won't ever create a gravitational wave signal, right? So that's sort of the fundamental issue here. And of course, people have, for many years, talked about how you might do that, and fundamentally, people talked about sort of two, say, different ways of doing it. One way is you start out with two stars pretty far apart, so there's plenty of room for them to expand and grow, and then you say that somehow it's in the process of binary evolution itself that something happens to bring the stars closer together during the time when it's acceptable to do that because the stars are already shrinking, right? Are collapsing to just their cores or compact objects, right? And the classical way of doing that, of course, is the common envelope, which is sort of a very nice tool in that regard because by design, a common envelope phase is something you initiate when your stars are big, right? When you've got a giant star that's overflowing its Roche globe in a dynamically unstable way. And of course, by ejecting this common envelope, you shrink down the binary by perhaps a couple of orders of magnitude because of all of the envelope binding energy that is removed from the binary's orbit in order to eject the envelope. Now, this is stuff we'll talk about later, so I don't want to go into this, just a quick comment that this is sort of one standard way. And the other standard way, of course, is you start out with two stars that aren't even in binaries with each other. They're just happily sitting somewhere on their own, and they each on their own with plenty of room around them because they have no companions or their companions are irrelevant for this purpose, collapse into black holes. So you have two black holes, except that you do this in a place where there are lots and lots and lots of other stars and lots of other black holes, because you're doing this in some dense stellar environment, say a nuclear cluster or globular cluster, and then you have all kinds of dynamic interactions and scatterings where, you know, two objects are at some point in a binary, and a third object comes by and removes a little bit more energy during a three-body interaction, let's say, than it came in with, and so this binary shrinks a bit, makes a closer binary, and this process keeps going until the binary gets hard enough that this gravitational wave emission can take over. Okay, so those are the two standard channels, isolated binary evolution and dynamical formation.
Perhaps worth noting that all it really takes is a third object. Right, there's the triple system work that
absolutely
looks interesting. That does it sort of without requiring N bodies.
You mean cosi?
Yeah. Right, so you can, yeah, absolutely. You can do lit of cosi cycles. Right, so okay, so my dynamics picture is sort of meant to be generic. You're absolutely right that in principle you could have a hierarchical triple and something that sufficiently excites the eccentricity of the inner binary that, again, what really matters, this is a bit of an oversimplification, what really matters, of course, is not the same major axis. What matters is the periapsis, if you wish, because gravitational wave emission is going to be dominated by the emission periapsis. So as long as you can drive down the periapsis distance, you can start having efficient gravitational wave emission. Absolutely. Okay. Dynamics are important. Isolated binary evolution, where you somehow start with the binary far enough apart that at least, you know, until the stars are good and ready to come together, you don't bring them too close together, right? But what if you could wave a magic wand and say, abracadabra, stars, thou shalt not expand? If you do that, life becomes very simple, because now you start out with two stars, massive stars, at a few tens of solar radii apart, and they happily evolve in situ and form two black holes, because they never expand, so as long as they weren't already in contact or weren't at least, you know, merging at zero age in the main sequence, they will never merge, and then life is good, they just form two black holes and they merge in a Hubble time, right? So a few years ago, Selma Deming told me that there is such a magic wand. I know that many of you knew about this magic wand much earlier. I'm just saying that I only learned about this from Selma a few years ago. That speaks only to my ignorance. And the magic wand is claimed to be, of course, chemically homogeneous evolution. So, okay, the basic picture, again, everybody is aware of, right, that as long as you have sufficiently efficient mixing, if we believe, despite, for example, Matteo's recent talk, which says that there could be many issues here, but if you believe that this is possible, if you have some reasonable preconditions, then you may be able to mix the star efficiently, so you continue to bring in hydrogen into the core and bring helium out, and eventually you convert almost all of the hydrogen in the star into helium, so you don't have this helium core contraction and hydrogen envelope expansion. At the end of the main sequence, instead, the whole thing just contracts. You end up going blue and small instead of red and big, and your star just contracts in place, right? So, as I said, I'm not going to try to justify this because we already had a week's worth of discussion on this by people who are far, far better experts in this than I am, but just to highlight sort of what are the preconditions, right? So you probably need a massive star. to do this, you probably need sufficiently low metallicity to do this. For one thing, if the metallicity is too high, you end up losing enough mass through winds that you just spin down your star. And you need to have rapid rotation.
You're assuming then that chemical homogeneous evolution is related to rotation.
So you have made
a really quick, big jump there.
Yes.
So I'll have a slide that says, I think there's no reason to think rapid rotation gives you chemically homogeneous evolution. There are perfectly good alternative solutions for what stars can do with rapid rotation, which are not chemically homogeneous.
Are there chemically homogeneous models that don't require rapid rotation?
I don't think so.
Okay.
I think they all require near breakup. I don't know. I'm not an expert on that.
Anyway, let's talk about this, but let him first tell what he can get if that's true, and then we'll trash it if it's not true.
So I'm perfectly happy for this to be... I'm perfectly happy for this to be trash, right? Let me say up front, I'm not in any way saying that this is the right channel for forming massive binaries. I'm completely agnostic about this. Okay, maybe I should say up front what my justification is, right, for why I think it's worth thinking about this despite all of the obvious uncertainties, right? My personal justification is that what I actually really want to do is I want to use, ultimately, gravitational wave observations to infer and understand something about binary evolution. And from that point of view, I would like to at least consider all of the plausible channels. Because, for example, it's obvious that, okay, forget about this channel for a moment, right? Forget about chemically homogeneous evolution, right? If, for instance, you know, these are two channels that are plausible, I think most of us would agree that these are at least reasonable, plausible channels, right? But if I, for example, magically ignore the dynamic information channel and only consider this one, and I imagine that all the gravitational wave sources out there form through this channel, and do some inference on what that tells me about binary evolution once LIGO detects enough sources, but actually, you know, 30% of them form through this channel, clearly my inference would be significantly biased. I would learn the wrong things from this, right? So from my point of view, I would like to at least consider this possibility. And then, you know, maybe for theoretical reasons, maybe actually observationally, because these channels do predict somewhat different properties of the binaries, I may be able to say, look, actually it turns out that this channel clearly is not playing an important role, and I'd be perfectly fine with that, right? But I do want to consider it just as a possibility, right? I'm not saying that I'm in no way trying to claim that this is the dominant channel, this explains all the sources or anything like that, right? Okay. So, but Matteo's and Elliot's points are absolutely right. You know, I am making an assumption that, based on some of the things we've heard earlier this week, that maybe if you have sufficiently rapid rotation, and you have sufficiently low metallicity, and your star is sufficiently massive, then maybe you can get this chemically homogeneous evolution. And if that happens, then probably, again, based on models that have largely been done by people, for example, working with Norbert and his colleagues, there's probably a parameter space where things can go through this chemically homogeneous evolution process. And if you assume that the rapid rotation here, sustained rapid rotation, is coming from the binary, right? So it's tidal coupling to the binary companion that is driving you to continue to be rapidly rotating, then there is sort of, you can make this diagram in sort of mass period space and say, look, things that are orbiting too quickly, you know, somewhere around here, you know, these things are out because these things are, you know, have already merged at zero age in the main sequence, right? And things which are sort of somewhere over here are out because they rotate too slowly. And there's a sliver that starts, you know, maybe at something like 40 solar masses, give or take, and, you know, orbital periods of order, you know, 1 to 2 days, again, give or take, I'm being intentionally very hand-wavy here, where you may have a window for chemically homogeneous evolution, because you keep the star sufficiently rapidly rotating through tidal coupling, and if the metallicity is low enough and the masses are high enough, maybe you can have this very efficient mixing, and maybe those stars can actually avoid expansion. Yes?
Can you clarify where your too slow starts in terms of a fraction of a critical rotation?
So I think... Sorry?
I will be sketching some of that.
Okay, so Pablo's going to sketch some of that, but it depends a bit on if a variety of other assumptions, such as, for example, what do you assume about the amount of mass loss through winds and so on and so forth. But you probably need to be, 40% of critical, somewhere around there, give or take. I mean, I think that's probably, ballpark.
How much masses is.
Yeah, it depends on the mass, it depends on the metallicity, but
basically, the 40% is when the mechanism starts to work.
That's what the models predict, if you trust all this rotational mixing.
Well, magnetic fields is the one that will keep it rigidly rotated, especially when the relative collision will be able to produce that, right? So,
this is assuming, most of the process that mixes is meridional situation.
You accounted for rotational dynamics?
In my models, at least I have, but I think some of these older models haven't. Or not.
I think this one also.
So,
this.
So the dynamic is the one which keeps the star rigidly rotating, but for the purpose of what you need to do, it's very good circulation, right?
I was sleeping.
So, but 40% is required for regional circulation to bring up a chemical potential.
Well, the thing about the magnetic fields is that if you don't have strong coupling, then you can have your outer layer spinning down. If you have strong coupling, then
yeah,
you spin down from
that,
the surface,
that
we propagate
profile,
to the surface.
But the mixing of the chemical elements goes through regional circulation.
I think in most moles it does, but if you have too much muscles, then you produce strong shear as well, and that can produce some mixing as well.
By the way, marginal currents are linked to
sulfide. So then you would like a fuzzy body muscle, you would like high metallicity, would you like high muscles?
Yeah, maybe that
would produce lots of shear. I was going to say that if you're allowing the binaries to spin the star up, the stellar wind's never going to take away binary angle momentum. So I'm not sure that the low Z is a real strong requirement.
No, but the binary widens, right? If you lose a lot of mass through winds, your binary as a whole will widen.
I'm saying that level is much higher than the kind of mass loss you would have to spin a star.
If you have magnetic fields, and every star has that, you lose angular momentum and it gets closer.
Yeah, if it's a magnetic field goes outside.
From the binary.
Yeah, but if it doesn't, as in Taylor's group.
I mean, things with winds are complicated anyway, because another thing that actually is that here we're talking about sufficiently compact binaries that you're still very much in the acceleration, your companion is very much in the acceleration zone of the wind. So you're not really in the fast wind regime, and so indeed, even ignoring the magnetic field issue, which I agree is an important one, it's actually possible that magnetic fields that winds will not necessarily lead the binary to widen because your companion is still interacting with the wind in the slow zone.
So is this correct? This is from reading the papers of people in this room. I thought that just the angular momentum loss from the mass loss, forget about magnetic torques, was enough to be problematic. And that was sort of the argument for a low metallicity.
Is there's no lever arm other than the
No lever arm.
Indeed. Indeed.
Okay, well, that was my interpretation.
If the specific angle momentum being lost is just the specific angle momentum at the surface, that the ratio of that specific angle momentum to the mean to the average angle momentum of a whole star. And then that means that you have to have basically a mass loss that's comparable to the mass of the star. You have to lose a substantial amount of the star in order to spin it down. And without a moment arm. But now we find that stellar winds are having a hard time doing that. They're having a hard time stripping the hydrogen envelope because of the reductions by factors of 2 or 3 or 4 because of clumping. So I don't think that it's necessarily the case, especially if you have the spin-up possibility from tidal locking, that you really have to worry about stellar winds pin you down.
Yes, but if you have this homogeneous evolution, you will enter rapidly into a kind of worthless phase.
Yeah, but okay, but the brains are very small, and therefore the monobank. Well, yeah, this is the same.
Can I ask just a question, just an observational question, in terms of so there's multiple reasons why this chemically homogeneous evolution is popular observationally, and outside of the being able to produce big black holes, there's just issues in low metallicity galaxies about the stellar populations. And can someone just summarize that very quickly? What is the observational motivation or the observational evidence for this channel for this chemically homogeneous picture? Sorry, did I miss it?
This was discussed a little bit. This question of whether there's evidence for enhanced rotational mixing, which sounded sort of ambiguous.
There are a few cases of stars that mm-hmm. appear to be hotter and more luminous than they're, they've been suggested that Lumen Gliese could be cases of chemical homogeneous evolution.
I think there's...
It's hard because, it's a bit, I think that the chemical homogeneous model can fit some of the track that fits some of these special stars. So there are a bunch of objects that hints to that possibility. But I don't think there is a clear observational proof of the existence of chemical evolution.
There is, Chuck Steidel has this work at Redshift 2, where I think the way to summarize it is the ionization state of the gas inferred from all this beautiful ionization diagnostics of H2 regions requires stars that are significantly hotter than standard single stellar evolution provides. So you need hotter stars, and this is one way to do it. There might be other ways to do it, but you definitely need hotter stars.
Yeah.
But that's a follow-up to Juno's question. Now, these kinds of objects would be almost trivial to actually find in resolved stellar populations, right? How many very short period 40 solar mass plus binaries in 2-day orbits do we know?
Yes, we know that.
Yes. Yeah, how many?
Not many, but there are.
I mean, the flame survey, right, that people were discussing earlier, right? There are certain observations of things with orbital periods of sort of a day and a half massive binaries. I mean, there is the sort of overcontinent binaries like the Almeida et al. Paper that Stephen doesn't believe, but nonetheless,
Okay.
There's some observational evidence. Now, whether that observational evidence necessarily tells you that these things are evolving chemically homogeneously, I think is very much an open question. Hints, at most, probably.
And is this something that astroseismology of very massive stars will, because of the abundance gradients and how they change, is this something that actually will be nailed down in the next 5 seconds?
Chemical homogeneity is expected to occur at very high mass, and that's basically no astroseismology in that regime. So I doubt that we will be able to
Why not? Why is there no astroseismology?
There's no star about 20 solar mass for which astroseismology has been.
Well, right, but with K2 and TESS and Plato, like, I think there will be some stars where you'll at least have
the mind. I think that astroseismology becomes extremely complicated in stars that have large amount of mass loss.
Yeah.
So it's probably
you know, Wolf Rayet stars, you don't see the photosphere. It's
right.
The optically thick wind.
Right.
Even if the wind isn't necessarily enough to, well, I mean, part of the point is that the chemical homogeneous channel to get a Wolf Rayet star, instead of removing the mass, you burn it. Right, and so it doesn't necessarily mean when you see a very massive Wolf Rayet star that you had a huge amount of mass loss. It's just now it's all been converted into helium because it's been channeled differently. So
maybe to add one point, one of the difficulties with astroseismology is that if it is true that it is related to fast rotation makes the analysis very complicated.
Right. Yeah, put the wind on top of it and it's a mess.
Okay, so. Sorry,
going to ask about the high mass X-ray binaries, if that was another snapshot of this phase potentially, and if there was a handle on that.
I'm going to briefly mention a bit of that.
Okay, great.
But I mean, keep in mind that at least in terms of high mass X-ray binaries and dynamical mass measurements, right? The most massive ones are sort of, you know, probably actually 10x1, and you see 300x1, right? And even those are questionable because you don't know whether you're measuring winds or orbital velocity. But even in those, I mean, the black hole mass, we're talking about sort of 20 solar masses, maybe 25, right? So it's, you know, difficult. I mean, these things are not going to be very common, right? I mean, actually, that's basically the next point I'm going to make, that although they can be interesting, because after all, things like binary black hole mergers are not very common to begin with, right? So it's okay to have rare channels that explain rare events, but fundamentally, it's not that you're going to expect to see a tremendous number of these kinds of systems around, right? They're actually evolving chemically homogeneously, where the whole binary is evolving chemically homogeneously. Pablo will talk a bit in a moment about things where maybe one of the companions is evolving chemically homogeneously and the other is not.
Although it is true, right? In the Milky Way, if these have lifetimes of a few million years, and if, this is a big if they were in the Milky Way, you would have many in the Milky Way today.
Sure.
Even so the merger rate in the Milky Way, the problem is you wouldn't in the Magellanic Clouds, because the stellar population is so much lower mass. So I think it's true that we don't have low metallicity systems that are well enough steady to know we should be seeing a progenitor, like even the black hole merger rate.
Well, in the galaxy, you have a particular binary. I think it's WR20A. So it was 280 or so solar mass stars that are in a very short orbit period. It's 4 days or so. Mm-hmm. So they appear to be more or less same mass, more or less core ball. Mm-hmm. And this is something that's hard to produce through combinatorial rules. It doesn't quite match the predictions of this, but I think that relates to the rate of orbital angular momentum loss, how that might be not be done quite correctly.
Okay, so I probably only have a couple of minutes left, but I just want to write down, therefore, just one very simple sort of Drake-like equation, right? Which is was my initial attempt when Selma told me that this is you know, a possible thing that could happen to stars, to try to estimate whether this could actually be relevant for example, binary black hole formation competitive with other channels and so on. And, you know, somewhat to my surprise, when Selma and I later implemented using, you know, obviously somewhat better motivated physical models, a population synthesis code for this. And when Pablo and collaborators have done their MESA simulations, the results are actually within a factor of a few of what you get from this simple argument. So maybe it's not completely insane. And maybe actually the uncertainties aren't all that high, unless, of course, you go to the extreme and say there's no such thing as chemically homogeneous evolution. OK, that obviously puts us to zero. OK, so you might say, OK, what is sort of the merger rate for, let's say, binary black holes formed through this channel per unit time, per unit volume? OK, it's the number of stars or number of binaries. Massive stars are almost all in binaries, so kind of same thing. You form per unit time, per unit volume, times a fraction of things which are massive enough, right? Because we're only interested in things that are, you know, at least a few tens of solar masses. Otherwise, this channel won't work. Times things which are at a sufficiently low metallicity. Otherwise, this thing doesn't work. Times the fraction of things which are sufficiently rapidly rotating, which, if you wish, is a constraint on the initial separation for these binaries, right? They have to be close enough together that tidal locking is going to give you enough rotation. And finally, times the fraction of things which, even if they do go through this channel, will actually merge in the age of the universe, because otherwise they don't contribute to binary black hole merger rates, right? So something like this is kind of a Drake equation for this problem. And
you say bound into supernova system, supernova explosions.
So that's a fair point. However, the issue here is that these binaries are so compact that their orbital velocities are, let's say, 600 kilometers per second, right? So at that point, unless you assume that, and remember, these are very massive systems, right? So unless you assume that your 30 solar mass black hole progenitor is going to get a natal kick of, you know, more than 600 kilometers per second, it's pretty difficult for a supernova to actually change the properties of the binary very much. So you can almost ignore the supernova explosions, unless you choose to give them, you know, typical kicks of 1,000 kilometers per second, which I think is fairly implausible.
Well, and I think getting a 30 solar mass black hole helps to not have an explosion.
I agree.
Indeed.
Or at least not to lose.
Basically, a subset of the GRB expectation fraction. So.
Sure. Oh, you're right. I mean, yes, you can go about computing this in other ways, right? This was my way of estimating, and not saying it's the best one, right? So, okay, for the number.
I also want to.
Sorry, please.
This keeping is also something that this way of evolution does not care too much about kicks, but either common envelope or dynamical formation cares a lot. So, if you get kicks of in your common envelope scenario, where you have your white binary, you put a kick there of a few tens of kilometers per second, and you lose your black hole. In the cluster, is the same thing because the escape velocities of the cluster are about that. So, well, this is a non-issue if your black holes just silently eat everything and have no momentum kick. But that's one point.
Yeah, that's a very good point, Pablo. Okay, so I mean. Okay, we know what the local star formation rate is. It's about 0.01 per cubic solar masses per cubic megaparsec per year. Now, okay, that was probably a factor of a few higher if you go to redshifts of 1 or 2. But you know, give or take, okay, I'm going to claim that this is something like 0.1 per cubic megaparsec so around 0.1 stars per cubic megaparsec per year. So 10 to the 8 stars per cubic gigaparsec per year. Okay, the fraction that are massive enough, well, if you just ask yourself, okay, in terms of the primary, and you say the primary has to be, let's say, 60 solar masses, what fraction of all stars, if you assume a Krupa IMF, will have a mass of above 60 solar masses? It's about 0.03%. Now, if you imagine that your mass distribution, mass ratio distribution is flat, that means a third of those will have also companions that are above 40 solar masses. So I'm going to say that about 0.01%, so 10 to the minus 4, are going to end up being roughly massive enough. Metallicity, well, it depends on exactly what is the lower limit for metallicity that you need. But even in the local universe, you have at least a few percent of things that, a few percent of star formation that happening at a metallicity of less than a quarter solar. If you go to higher redshifts, obviously that increases. So I'm going to set this to be about 10%.
That sounds quite high for the low metallicity.
You can go, well, it depends on how low you demand, right? So I think Pablo finds that you probably need to go to maybe a tenth solar. So again, it depends on at what redshift you are considering most of these sources as having formed. But okay, you can tune this down. You can tune this down to 0.01. It's not crazy. There's plenty of, even in the local universe, there's plenty of low metallicity star formation, right? There's quite a big spread, probably something like 0.5 dex. In terms of the spread in the star formation metallicity, right?
Also, there's anti-correlation between the F massive and FZ, right? Presumably, the lower metallicity galaxies have a topper heavy.
Possibly, I don't know. I think that the discussion whether IMF is universal or not is a whole separate question that probably is. Okay.
Those two things are coupled.
Which is very common, but it's not.
Yeah, I'm not convinced that personally from I'm not an expert, but from what I've read, I'm not convinced that there's actually convincing evidence that the IMF is not universal. So I'm going to assume that. Sorry for the double negative. You will convince me the IMF is not universal. Okay. Then we will wait for Fabian to convince us that the IMF is not universal. All right. This one, actually, you might say, well, okay, this is the most uncertain one, right? Because we don't know, after all, exactly where these boundaries are. But actually, it's not so bad, because if you assume something like Oeppig's law, right, which tells you that, you know, the distribution of the initial periods or initial separations goes as sort of uniform in the log, it actually doesn't matter all that much if you shrink this window by a factor of 2 or you expand it by a factor of 2. I mean, roughly speaking, you have something like, you know, in terms of the initial separation of binaries, you have several orders of magnitude that you're spanning. So in terms of factors of 2, you have, you know, let's say, you know, 15 factors of 2 that you're conceivably spanning, something like that, right? So if this is, you know, a factor of 2, you get, you know, 1/10 or 1/15 of all binaries that start out at reasonable separations, right? So I'm going to set this to be, you know, with this back of the envelope hat on, I'll set this to be about 0.1 as well.
I mean, 10 minus 7 can take, you have binaries up to 10 and 7 days. Why are you taking 0.1?
Oh, sorry, because okay, that's fine. So 10 to the 7 days, all right. So. All right, you prefer 10 to the 7 days. Okay, fine. So Natasha wants the binaries to go from...
Sure.
So Natasha wants to say that we go from 1 day to 10 to the 7 days, right? So that's, okay, so that's 6 orders of magnitude, right?
Yes.
Each order of magnitude is 3 factors of 2. So that's 18 factors of 2. If I claim that this window is about 1 factor of 2, that means if things are uniform in the log, 1/18 will fall into this window. Okay, 1/18 is 1/20. Okay, so changes from 0.1 to 0.05. If you want to reduce this stuff by a factor of 2, I'm not claiming this is exactly within a factor of 2, right? I mean, this is order of magnitude. Factor of 2, I'm perfectly fine with. You want me to write 0.05? I'll happily write 0.05.
Sure. Ilya said that this was going to be like the Drake equation. So.
No. But it's not. Okay, again, Natasha. The point about the six order. Okay, so the important point is that the initial separation, right, is roughly uniform in the log. Actually, according to some of Uksana's and company's arguments, you even have a preference for shorter period systems. So if anything, you know, a higher fraction would be in this regime of being nearly in contact, right? So the fact that it's uniform in the log, I think, saves you.
The next paper on M17 claims the other way around, that there's a dearth of objects at short periods in M17.
Sorry, which paper is this?
Uksana's most recent paper on M17 actually shows that the observed population can only be explained if you have a dearth of systems at short periods.
But this level of accuracy will give you
to make it more about.
Sure. Yeah. I agree with you, Ellie, but it's still very
much. In 1 and 2 days, we don't have much observations, right? And exactly
which
you want.
We know that systems exist in this window. I completely agree with you that, you know, fine, you can reduce it by a factor of 10. There are only some systems there, right? The last comment is that this fraction is actually very close to 1, and that's simply because if you really do go through this chemically homogeneous evolution channel, you are, by construction, so close together that you will merge within the age of the universe. You just can't avoid it, right? So this fraction is almost unity. In fact, actually, for some of at least our assumption, it basically is unity. Okay. So now multiplying this out, 10 to the 8 times 10 to the minus 4 is what? 10 to the 4, 10 to the 3, 10 to the 2. So I get 100 per.
You get
10 gigawatts per year. Now, Natasha, I'm perfectly happy with reducing this by a factor of 10. Let's bring this to 10 per cubic gigaparsec per year. Now, I aim to keep our lead organizer happy. So the point is that the current rate inferred from, for example, LIGO observations, it's pretty broad because only, you know, it's based on 2.9 detections, but it's something like, you know, 9 to 250, I don't remember the exact number, per cubic gigaparsec per year. So in principle, you know, this is somewhere in that ballpark, which means that conceivably, right, this is an order of magnitude calculation, right? The only point I'm trying to make here is that conceivably this is a relevant channel, because the fact that this number is roughly in the right ballpark means that if you believe that this channel actually is possible, if you believe that chemically homogeneous evolution can happen in these kinds of systems, then it could be a non-negligible contributor to the binary black hole merger rate. That's all. Whether it really is remains to be seen.
Okay. I think we should now.
Yes, I'm done.
So turn that to show that long.
Same. 42, actually.
42 is a very good number.
I wasn't expecting you to erase that one.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
No worries, sis.
Okay, I'll get right again. Sit down.
No.
No, just leave it as this. Okay, so I briefly wanted to discuss a bit about conditions for under which you would expect like both stars to evolve chemically homogeneous. Why would both go that way? Why would just one do it perhaps under given circumstances or none of them? So Natasha asked before of what this means in terms of critical rotation. And for that, one thing you should have in mind is that you have something like this for, well, you have this for the critical rotation of a star if you include as well the contribution from radiation. So that's your Eddington luminosity over L, which is essentially proportional to.
Yeah, upside down. Upside down.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Yep,
you have that. And if you consider a main sequence stars that are powered by CNO burning, you typically have that biomology arguments that this scales something like that. And this means that your critical frequency decreases as you go high in mass. So, well, just to plot a bit the numbers you get out of this, your omega critical in terms of your sun's mass. So you have about, if you go from 10 to the minus 4 to about 4 times 10 to the minus 4, and you go from 10 to 100, this essentially covers this range, at least in low metallicities. Of course, this is metallicity dependent. The numbers I spit out of this were for a quite metal poor environment. So this is for solar metallicity over 50. So now taking that into account, if we believe these diffusion approximations for rotational mixing, we can draw a region for single star at least, at which we expect chemically homogeneous evolution to work. So then again, this becomes metallicity dependent. And what I'm sketching is sort of what I get at very low metallicity. And then if you have about your 20 solar masses up to 100, and you're plotting your the ratio, the how close to critical rotation you are at the zero age main sequence, you get a region that sort of something like this, where here you have 0.8 and here you have 0.1 or something. So this sort of flattens out to 0.4. It might do some funnier things up here, but I would like to remain in this range. Now, as I was saying before, so this is 0.4. You have that your critical frequency decreases with mass. So if you actually go over here, and well, I think maybe I can use a different color. If you go over here and plot lines of constant angular frequency for a given mass, then you end up with lines that go like this. So this is something like 0.7 days. There you have 1 day, and at some point, you don't expect that your stars to fall inside this region. And just starting from this point, you can say what our binaries are expected to do. So in a binary, I would expect, if they're close enough,
essentially they are tidally locked, so of course their periods are the same. And at a given orbital separation, I would expect both stars to fall inside this one of these lines. So at lower masses, for instance, I could have here, imagine a 20 solar mass star plus a 20 solar mass star in a 0.7 day orbit. And both of these stars fall outside this range for mixing. So you expect neither of them to evolve chemically homogeneous. If one of the stars has a higher mass, at some point it could fall inside here. And then you would have one star evolving this way. And if both stars are of about the same mass, then you could have both of them evolving chemically homogeneous. And this produces different outcomes, whether you have one or the other thing happening of this. Well, exotic outcomes, one of them is what Ilya was saying about merging binary black holes. So before pushing forward, just to say, this is an argument that's using results from single stellar evolution to conclude things about binary stellar evolution, which is not quite right. So in a single star with a given angular frequency, omega dot is essentially given by the angular momentum at the surface that is being lost through the wind. In a binary, this is different. So if you have your binary and one of your stars is losing mass, then you expect the most important angular momentum contribution to be in here, to actually be the orbital angular momentum. So in a way, this leads back into the orbital separation evolution. And this feeds back into the evolution of your stellar frequency. So this is not quite straightforward, and this is where we usually make a strong assumption that these winds are fast winds. Actually, you would expect the velocity of these winds to be comparable to the orbital velocity. So this could potentially break down. And instead of what you typically expect with this assumption is that this guy's widened with mass loss. So there you get a similar thing that you favor lower metallicities because you increase your separation and you decrease your orbital frequency. But if you have strong interactions of the wind with the orbit, maybe this thing even gets closer together with wind mass loss, which might actually favor these things. But this is an open question. I mean, most of these things are only recently being explored. I think Ilya already discussed enough about the skies. This situation where you have two stars in this range and you form two black holes. I guess another situation which also came up, I could say something about that, is if you have one star evolving chemically homogeneous and the other doesn't. So in that case, if I have my two stars with a happy convective cores inside, I would have one of these guys undergoing strong mixing throughout and eventually forming a black hole. If the other guy doesn't evolve chemically homogeneous, then you expect to have an X-ray binary out of this. So this guy will expand. And at some point, it will initiate mass transfer. So what you expect to come out of this, the nature of this X-ray source, is to get an ultra-luminous source out of it. And the reason is that the black hole masses that are predicted for this are typically in excess of 20 solar masses. So this by itself, even if I have completely limited Eddington-limited mass transfer rates to the black hole, I expect a luminosity in excess of this 10 to the 39 ergs per second, which is what defines, more or less defines a ULX. So then again, you have this multitude of outcomes that On this regime, you produce merging black holes. In this regime, you would produce ULXs. And you could even keep pushing this forward as an alternative. And if, after a mass transfer phase from this, you would get your black hole plus a perhaps lower mass helium star. I don't like to write Wolf right yet because I think that's an observational definition. This is my theoretical definition in here. And if this thing is low, is of low enough mass, then you will get something going boom and producing a neutron star in here. And another possibility that pops out of this is that you produce a quite eccentric orbit out of this, and you get your gravitational wave merger of a neutron star plus a black hole. So pushing it this way as well, you get as well a different kind of gravitational wave source. Not a very efficient one, because mass transfer widens this system still significantly, but still something that perhaps someday could be probable.
Paolo, before you go on, in the phase where you are in the Rockloop overflow, where you say you get the ultraluminous source, as everybody knows here, I'm not a theorist, but I calculated once that if you're in a Roche geometry, the rotation of each of the Rochelot villain component can never be more than one third of the critical rotation of the component.
Yeah, but this.
So that would fall.
This guy is not mixed.
So that guy is not mixed.
So okay. That guy is okay, this
so
one.
That, so, that, so, but that's sitting much lower than right in your diagram here. So it cannot exceed 0.3 in your limit.
Yeah. Of course, it can be one of these as well.
It's just for illustration purposes. Right?
But this is the formation frequency. So this is what the star has at the beginning.
Oh, okay.
So this is much later on in the evolution. So this does not need to reflect what was happening right at the start. So you will have some orbital evolution that due to tidal coupling will affect as well the frequencies.
So as excited as I am about the gravitational wave sources, and you really have to have no soul not to be. I do actually think there's a lot of interesting observational constraints or potential constraints in this other phase that you're describing, both the ULXs. And I guess I want to understand a little bit better what limits you have from your theoretical models about what those combinations can be in terms of the donor and the black hole, right? So is 20 really a firm lower limit in these calculations for the black hole mass that underwent this chemically homogeneous picture? So how firm are those predictions?
So I would say that depends strongly on this. So the issue is that at higher metallicities, you can still have this channel of evolution. But for this to be a long-lived phase, you want this to happen in the main sequence. So if this doesn't happen in the main sequence, you just get a thermal timescale mass transfer phase, and the chances of observing that are tiny. So I actually I'm producing numbers out of this of how many you would expect to see, and the typical language that people talk about this is in terms of star formation rate. There's actually a metallicity dependence of this. So if you plot log C against number per SFR, let's put the metal rich on this side and metal poor on this side, you expect something with a peak going from 1 to 3 or so. And usually when the rates of ULX people talk about are about there. So there are significant caveats to this, but it produces, this is something as well as what Ilya was showing from this Drake equation sort of way, this produces something that's comparable to what you expect to observe. So you would expect it to be relevant at some point, and and testable. That's the important part.
So the populations, I think, are extremely interesting, but I guess I'm also just interested in very specific systems in the Milky Way that you could maybe look for that have very, you know, I mean, so I think one very interesting thing is that the high mass X-ray binary spins are high, and those spins are derived in different ways than, of course, the gravity wave spins, and so there are caveats associated with that, particularly in terms of alignment, similar to everything, but, you know, I mean, are you guys thinking of specific systems that may be locatable within our galaxy or in nearby, you know, a very local volume that you can actually say that is a product that cannot be produced by some other, that, you know, living system, not a dead merging system, cannot be produced.
So, there are some systems. One thing you have from observing some of these ULXs, it's hard to get orbital solutions out of it. You have a couple that can be tested that way, but for most you have, I think, about 20 or so that have an optical counterpart observed by Hubble. And one thing they get from that is that it seems they require quite massive secondary stars. So in some cases they need a black hole undergoing mass transfer with a 50 solar mass companion. And that's very hard to produce in any other way. For instance, in common envelope evolution, it's very hard to produce such an extremely massive black hole. And if you don't have a black hole that has a mass comparable to the donor, then you will get a short-lived phase. So it's the tyranny of the thermal timescale mass transfer that makes that unlikely. And in that case, this sort of seems favorable because it's quite easy to produce these extreme massive black holes. And if at some point these observations get good enough that you start getting good constraints on the orbital parameters of the systems, then you have a very clear sign in terms of the mass ratio distribution this predicts compared to everything else. So it still has ways to go because it's quite hard to get orbital parameter constraints in the systems because they're far away. But you would expect it to happen.
This M33X7 system, which has a 70 solar mass star and a 16 solar mass black hole in a 3 or 4 day orbit, would that?
So what are the masses for that one again?
70 for the donor star and something like 16 for the black hole, and they have an orbit of about 4 days, I think. M33X7. And yeah. Would you be able to make it by this channel?
I think the main issue would come from environment constraints. Hmm? So
it has a low metallicity, M33.
Yeah, at low metallicity you could, if your metallicity is not that low, you could have that thing. So if your black hole still lost plenty of mass, so I mean you have something that's 70 plus a 17 solar mass black hole. So
16 or something.
Yeah. So this has the original secondary being much more massive. So then you need the black hole to have lost a significant amount of mass to get there.
Yeah.
So then you're still beyond the regime of what these models do. But all of that might very well be contained in this uncertainty. So if this works quite differently, you could have those kinds of systems.
And one other, that system which you have there with one with a strong wind and the other not having such a strong wind, that will produce a Wolf-Rayet binary, O star plus a Wolf-Rayet star at some point, I would think. If you have your mixing, it becomes a helium star, which is a Wolf-Rayet star, with a short orbital period. And there are two Wolf-Rayet binaries that have orbital periods less than 2 days. And I've always been wondering, how could nature have made those systems? Would this be a channel to make them?
Well, then, back again, I think you could make them, but then you start going towards the theoretical freedom of playing with this. So I can't say at first that you could make those. But maybe if one works it out and puts some proper theoretical constraints on how actually the orbit responds to mass loss, maybe you could get this.
Do you have rotation rates for the O star? Do you have rotation rate for the big star from the lines or anything, or no?
I don't know that, but one is V444 Cygni, which I have 1.6 day orbital period, and it's an O star plus a Wolf Rayet star. And I would think your chemically homogeneous channel could nicely make the Wolf Rayet star. Looks like some example.
Yeah, I mean, there's as well this other system I mentioned, this WR20A, so this extremely massive, that appears to be almost same mass, yeah. Very helium-rich binary. And that's, I mean, that's a compelling argument that maybe you have something of this sort happening.
Okay.
So I would say you have some systems that point to this. No, none of them are conclusive. But there are things that become extremely tricky to explain with common envelope evolution. You start demanding things like a simultaneous common envelope of two cores that eject both envelopes at the same time, and things of the sort.
Yeah.
And that starts sounding a bit improbable. I guess you can put out numbers for it and see whether you expect something to happen. But due to the difference in timescales that would require such fine-tuning, I don't expect those things to be very likely.
If you could just have the one observation from the sky, like just one, like literally like one in your inbox, like one plot showed up that was just the truth and you just got it, what would it be? Like what would it be to say, like, what is the smoking gun of this yet?
I would say a LIGO black hole merger with high aligned spins.
That would be nice.
That's an observation as well. That would be a recent thing coming up, but that's an option. In terms of a more, so something
maybe physically, like what?
Yeah, I mean, something I missed up in here are as well the whether this happens or not, whether you form your black hole. So this is a mechanism that turns your stars into huge helium stars, and in that case, it's quite easy to make very massive helium stars. And what happens, what you expect to happen in a range between 60 to 130 solar masses of this approximate, in this range, your general expectation is a perinstability supernova. So out of this, you get no remnant and potentially no signal in terms of black hole mergers. So one thing you could see out of this from LIGO data eventually is that once you get a population of sources, because from single sources it's very hard to say anything at all, if you have your two masses, you would have an attraction. You would essentially get a gap in those. And if you see both this guys and this guys, I think that's a strong argument for chemically homogeneous evolution in particular. Producing these guys, it's very hard any other way.
I have just a question about this, the response of Hawking with respect to the mass loss.
Mm-hmm.
So if the star loses a lot of mass, it will break down. But at the same time, tidal interaction will tend to speed up again. So it will take orbital angular momentum to put it in the star, and this will make us to start to approach, right?
Well, by construction, at first you have that J is larger than 3 times S1 plus S2. This is your initial condition. Otherwise, it's Darwin unstable. So right from the beginning, you can see that the spin contribution is already just a third of the orbital one. So in most of the systems, unless you have the most extremely tight ones, spin orbit coupling plays a secondary role in defining the orbital evolution.
Yeah, so commenting on that, stellar winds from massive stars, if they're driven by lines, are almost always several thousand kilometers per second. And that's going to exceed your orbital speed. So I think the approximation.
But what's your wind acceleration region?
Right. So this is the point I was making earlier. That these binaries are very compact, and so your companion is still in the acceleration zone. So you can still have tidal friction, for example, against the winds, and that can actually possibly reverse the effect that Natasha just mentioned, right? Because so you can actually have, it may not expand as much as you would in the infinite wind approximation. Infinite wind velocity approximation may conceivably contract, depending on the details of the interaction with the
rod. Fast wind, infinite, instantaneous removal approximation. Mm-hmm. You're removing orbital angular momentum of the star that's losing mass.
Yep.
You're losing orbital angular momentum. And if you lose orbital momentum from the system, shouldn't the two stars come together?
No, because you're reducing the mass of the system as well.
Oh, okay.
So this conspires, if you take into account everything properly, that it widens.
Okay.
I mean, the shape of supernova mass law is just gradual.
Yeah, I think we should a little bit stop the discussion on the binary system, because we still will be coming back to that topic later, and let Ellie talk about a little bit of the rotation itself.
We can also do this over beer tonight.
Is it so bad?
Well, no. It's just,
we have plenty of blackboards over at the...
Yeah, it's just I don't really understand, and this is not, I haven't actually worked on this, it's just reading the literature. I think the, at least to me, the argument that rapid rotation produces chemically homogeneous evolution from just a physics point of view seems rather weak. I think the kind of models that are...
That's very relevant.
That's very relevant. That's what I want to hear.
I mean, again, this is from reading the literature. This is not something I've actually worked on. And in particular, it comes back to something that a couple of people mentioned. Really, the central issue is the issue of the competition between thermal transport and angular momentum transport. So there is a lot of very, very nice work that goes back to what just after Eddington and Sweet, showing that that in the limit of rapid rotation, one happy solution that stars go to is just to have some differential rotation. So they have absolute no meridional circulation, zero, and they just have some differential rotation. So there's two possible solutions in the limit of rapid rotation.
By R or by altitude?
I think in general it has to be both, but by R in particular. In general, there'll probably be a little bit of that. So I think what, to me, is completely unclear is that the assumption of Eddington-Sweet circulation is only right at even, we're not talking about this ambiguity of the fudge factor that you put in front of the estimate of the diffusion coefficient. We're talking about at the factor of a million level, right? So is only right if the star is close to solid body rotation. If the star, there is a completely different solution that the star can adopt, which is happy hydrostatic equilibrium, thermal equilibrium, you know, satisfies all the equations, which is that it's differentially rotated with no, again, no meridional circulation. And so I think the way to think of this really is that, and there's a nice paper by Pascal Guéraud that does this for an idealized model, is that there's really a competition between thermal time scale diffusion, which does want to set up some meridional circulation, and viscous time scale redistribution of angular momentum. I mean, the question is which wins. So the way she formulates this is that there's really a dimensionless parameter. Let's see if I have this right. Yeah. And
so that's viscosity on the top.
So this is viscosity, and this is thermal diffusivity, kappa. So this is the thermal diffusion coefficient, and this is basically the ratio of Brunt to, so that's the stabilizing buoyancy. It's all in a radiative zone. So it's the ratio of Brunt to the rotation rate. And if this is large compared to 1, then you get Eddington-Sweet. And if this is small compared, so then you get the kind of standard meridional circulation estimates. And if this is small compared to 1, then you get differential rotation with essentially no meridional circulation.
It's called sort of differential rotation.
You know, I think it depends, but it's roughly omega is some power law in radius. So it's a.
So you're using radial?
Yeah, this is. No, these are usually two-dimensional calculations.
Oh, okay.
When people have done this, yep. But I think in particular, the important part is there is, I mean, it's the differential rotation in radius which is, I think, the harder one to get rid of. Although, again, if there's magnetic fields, it may well be possible. So this is the Brunt-Bisala frequency, which is the buoyancy. So the way to think of this is this number actually, if we're near breakup, is not that different from 1, okay? And so that's where it really comes down to, again, this competition between viscous redistribution of angular momentum, which wants to, maybe wants, we don't know, set up solid body rotation, maybe not. From all the stuff Matteo said, it's pretty clear that magnetic torques are not efficient enough to establish perfect solid body rotation. They're also not inefficient enough to give you conservation of angular momentum.
Now, for Pascal's work, that was a fluid new, right?
But think of it as a turbulent, I mean, exactly. Right. So the microscopic value of this number is tiny. Yeah. I have this backwards. The microscopic value of this number, yes, is tiny. Right, exactly. So microscopically, stars transport heat much better than momentum collisionally, right? And so the question, this is what Lars is getting at, is really, I think the question is, what is the kind of turbulent transport of angular momentum?
So on the Earth, that number is much larger than 1. So that, the first term is a Prandtl number, basically.
Yeah.
So that's about 1. And so, but on the Earth, the rotation rate is small, so that number is very large.
Yep.
And so you have actually hydrogen sweet cell in the atmosphere.
Right.
But in a star, the now that because the Prandtl number is very small.
Exactly. So I would say the natural thing that kind of the most naive star models would do would not be Eddington sweet circulation at all. It would be to have some differential rotation. And then the question is the hard problem, which I think, so meaning no chemically homogeneous evolution, right? Because again, it's the Eddington sweet circulation, which my understanding and from looking at MESA models, this seems to be the case, is the dominant source of mixing in chemically homogeneous evolution, although Pablo was referring maybe to some limit where you can do it with shear instabilities. So I think the question then is back to the problem that Matteo talked about, which we clearly don't know the answer to, but it's a hard problem, is there a regime, and it just has to be a tiny fraction of stars, right, to do the interesting things that that Pablo and Ilya want. It just has to be a small fraction of stars, right? Is there a fraction where they do have, say, large enough magnetic fields to promote solid body rotation? So the way, if you want to think about it in terms of magnetic fields, the naive estimate, I would say, is you want, and it's not clear this is the right estimate, but you probably want something like the following. You want the magnetic torques transport of angular momentum, units, right? So this is kind of your Maxwell stress that's redistributing angular momentum. You want that to be large enough that on an Eddington sweet time scale, it can move around the entire angular momentum of the star, okay? And remember, this is basically the Kelvin-Helmholtz time scale for the case we're talking about. It's something like this. So the Eddington sweet time scale, something like the thermal time scale, times the rate, times how close to critical you are, but we want to be really close to critical for all of this, so it's kind of a thermal time scale. And this is actually a pretty big, if you just plug in estimates for massive stars, this kind of is some measure of how strong the magnetic field has to be, root BRB phi needs to be 10^3 to 10^4 Gauss.
Elliot, how does it end up comparing to the Alphane wave crossing time across the star relative to the Kelvin-Helmholtz time? So the old arguments for the sun, way back when they started about long-term differential rotation for the sun.
That's right.
Was the naive argument that
I think that
the point on the toroidal time scale is the Alphane wave time at the original B field strength.
Yeah, so that's the time scale on which that's a causality argument that you need to be able to. You need to have enough time to redistribute the angle, to causally connect by transmitting Alphane waves across the star. I think that is much easier to satisfy than this, because the issue is in the limit you're thinking of, one Alfvén crossing time scale, that's when you start to really wind up the field. And implicit in my assumption here is that I'm not going to get b-phi way bigger than br, because it's going to be limited by instabilities. So I believe your condition is easier to satisify than this condition.
But I'd be curious to check this for the sun.
Yeah, we could double check this. Yeah, for the sun, I mean, this is what people have done. I forget the number, but to get an interior, to get solid body rotation in the interior, I actually forget the number. It's a small field. It's a weak field.
But, right, but this would have to be your argument.
Well, except the Eddington sweep time scale is longer than the age of the sun. So this really isn't a huge issue in the sun. So I think this specific issue is not a huge issue in the sun. But generically, is the B field strong enough? Is a fossil field strong enough to promote solid body rotation? I would just say the only thing I would change is it wouldn't be Eddington sweep. It would just be lifetime of the sun. That's the only difference. Then I agree, this one would want to do that. And I kind of remember Gauss, but I might be wrong. I'd have to go back and double check that for the sun.
So why does it need to be a fossil field? I mean, if you involve Taylor's Sprout dynamo, like, and can you get out with that?
You could. This is just to give you a sense of how strong. I mean, this is how strong the magnetic field has to be wherever it comes from. This is a big field, right? Yeah. We're excited to find some massive stars with Kilgauss fields. So this is.
But we only need to find size. If you
absolutely
make a trace back from the remnants which are four, for example, neutron star, can you suggest what was magnetic field had to be before? Maybe it has to be 10 and 4.
I mean, that depends when. And again, this is in the we're interested in the radiative zone, not in the convective core. The convective core has stronger fields than this, I think. So, you know, and again, it's very possible that this rapidly rotating star, in trying to set up meridional circulation, develops a strong dynamo that gives us this strong field. But I think that the physics step, I guess the thing I just want to emphasize is that the physics step from rapid rotation to lots of mixing is actually, to me at least, completely unclear because of this issue. That to me, it's back to the previously unsolved problem that Matteo talked about, which is angular momentum transport. And do you go to a state of solid body rotation, in which case then you will have efficient meridional circulation, or do you go to a state of differential rotation in which you may have not very little mixing? So I think that's a really interesting physics problem, and it is a hard enough one that maybe these observational routes that people are talking about, trying to find evidence for chemically homogeneous stars, is the way to go, because this is a pretty tough problem. But it's a very interesting one, I think. So.
But when you say you will have very little mixing in the differentially rotating case, you will have little mixing by meridional currents.
Yes,
right?
Good. So yes. So maybe then shear instabilities become absolutely great. No, very good point. Yes, you're right. So specifically, what I said was just a statement about Eddington sweep circulation. Absolutely. So that's an interesting question.
It's similar to what Andrea and Georgia discussed a little bit of different concepts, but by having the surface spin down rapidly because of the magnetic field, and then you increase the amount of shear.
And you get a large shear, yes.
In a rapid rotation case, and then can actually lead to a very large amount of mixing.
And I don't, I don't actually understand well enough, I mean, maybe the experts can comment, whether anything like this, where you replace nu with some measure of turbulent viscosity, is actually in the 1D stellar evolution codes. Meaning, one could imagine something interesting where you go in and say, I'm going to suppress Eddington sweep mixing if I'm in this limit of the inequality, and I'm going to impose strong Eddington sweep circulation if I'm in this limit, where nu is now the turbulent nu. And this would get at exactly your point, that maybe in trying to go to this regime, you set up so much differential rotation that you become shear unstable, which pushes you back into this. That's an interesting question. And maybe there is something, I haven't thought about this, kind of off the cuff, but maybe there's something interesting one can do to try to put approximate versions of this into 1D calculations, which would be
relatively straightforward just to do a run with Addington sweep turned off,
right.
Yeah.
Seeing if shear instabilities step up to the plane.
And exactly, and figure out how big they are. That's right. Yes. So that would be an interesting step. That's right.
Is it all about new? You're assuming the cap was going to stay pretty much the same.
I am assuming that the heat transport. I mean, I think so. I think that's
we're
a good
focusing assumption. On how
unless you become convective
for some weird. Yeah.
How do you estimate this new if it's a gradually zoned stuff? Doesn't have a
right. So that's where I'm, you know, invoking some magnetic field or shear instabilities, right? But all the I think the. So I think, you know, what Matteo's talk was that we don't really know how to estimate nu in the sense of angular momentum transport because there's all these puzzles that we're still trying to understand. And it's great that we now have good, you know, interesting observational constraints on it. But one could do experiments where you use the best guesses of the turbulent nu and see what effect that has. That's an interesting.
The one that comes from the Taylor gets closer.
Yeah, that's right.
That's a good starting
that's
point.
Right. Yep.
Even if maybe that's not the physical process, at least we know the order of magnitude of the.
Yeah, it's
like
physical
variability.
I think that's actually what you're doing, isn't it? I mean. In the Geneva models, any sweet circulation is not dominant, so it doesn't do much. But then the shear mixing provides the answer to what we see.
So I guess that adds.
Our models, it is such that the spark Taylor brings us to the rigid rotation solution. So it's too fine to have the Eddington sweet current in there, so it's all consistent with what we say.
So why is it that in the MESA models it's Eddington sweep and in the Geneva models it's shear?
Those are not the MESA, they're the Stern models.
The guy enforces solid body rotation, so you don't have shear.
Oh, I see. It's hydro versus. Ah, good. Okay. Now I understand.
If you turn off
the
spring Taylor, you get to the
right.
Geneva
right.
solution.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that was it.
That was good.